Welcome to Me Coughing, to introduce you to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. It's a full show tonight, and my first guest for this entire hour is a young woman, Cinia Curran Finfer, 20-some years ago,
yes.
On the top of a mountain, I guess a mountain, or top of
Hollywood
a hill in Beverly Hills, I went to one of the coolest weddings in the world where I bored one of your guests, Scott Glenn, the movie actor, half to death, and was sort of joyously happy meeting your family and meeting your husband, who I'd met before, David Finfer. And now you're an author. Cinia's book is titled Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood, True-ish Tales of an Analog Upbringing. It is as charming a book. I'm not a person who grew up as a girl in the 60s and 70s, but I relate to every single one of these stories, Cinia, and I think a lot of it has to do with the first line of your book, where you write, childhood is not a tidy process. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
You are here with your lifelong, almost lifelong friend,
yes.
Jennifer Bosnos,
getting
back into the PR game after many years away. Jennifer, one of my dearest friends I will ever have. And I'm going to get her take on the book because she understands you in a way that I do not. Cinia, what is the seed of this book? It is a series of very short kind of essays about adventures in childhood, rather idyllic to me.
Well, I like to call it epic tales, and I think we all have our epic tales. And maybe it's the thing that you talk about at a family reunion or, you know, remember when Aunt Mary tried to give the cat a bath or, you know, remember the first time Billy did the barbecue and we lit the entire porch on fire. You know, that sort of thing. We all have those stories. So, what I thought, I didn't think I had the chops to do a novel. And my first inspiration of this was a book called Altered States by a woman named Jenny Nash, who at the time was a reporter for New York Woman magazine. I was working with Renee Strauss for The Bride in Beverly Hills, who's a top designer. And we were doing an event, and we were doing a tie-in with Jenny. And her book, Altered States, was the trajectory from her older sister's getting engaged to the actual wedding day.
Mm-hmm.
But it was arranged in essay form, and we progressed from one to the other. But I had this aha moment going, I could do this. This I could do. I could do self-contained essays. And so the idea of what I did was I sort of started with, I had about 20 stories. And then, you know, you have to cull the herd. And I also wanted to sort of create a bit of a trajectory from a chronological standpoint, but I had a very unusual childhood in that I went to five different grade schools and three different high schools.
This is one of the amazing things about this book. I had to play detective while reading this book. And right first, I write down Bloomfield Hills. That's a suburb of Detroit.
Right.
Then there's Camelback Drive. I have no idea where that is.
Edina, Minnesota.
There were two places in Minnesota?
Well, no. Let me give you the trajectory. I was born in New York City. I lived in Manhattan, Ryan, Portchester. Started my education at Ridge Street Elementary in New York. And then we moved to Detroit. My dad was working for Ford Motor Credit Corporation. And first we went to Traub Elementary, where the first chapter happens. And then we went to St. Hugo's of the Hills Catholic Church and school. And I was there from third until half of fourth grade. And then we moved to Edina, Minnesota, where I entered fourth grade at Edina Highlands School, which was a very progressive IPA, individualized prescribed instruction. Go at your own pace. And you can imagine my father, being a New York financier, was not impressed. But we got through that. And then we bounced to Cleveland, Ohio, where we started in sixth grade at Brady Middle School. And then I went to Orange High School till 10th grade, Lake Forest High School for only half of 10th grade. And then I landed at Woodlands Academy of the Sacred Heart, where I met
Jennifer
Bosnos. This lovely lady and a few others who still are very much in my life.
There must be a reason that these stories stop before you get to high school.
Well, this is childhood.
Too dangerous.
This is childhood, and you know, we have a code of silence as a way to operate
code of silence
Chicago.
About some of the things,
you know,
in the book,
I know
too.
Stuff, and she knows stuff, and we're not talking.
In writing this, Cinia, you're a very talented writer, and so I have to ask. In drafting this book, did you say to yourself, I'm going to put these stories that I remember down on paper and see what happens? Or did you conceptualize a book from the very start?
Well, I think what I did was I knew these stories. This was Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood was sort of a phrase I used with friends. Like, we'd do something, and then I'd wink and say, ugh, that's my confession from a helmet-free childhood. And I think, you know, I'm 59. I have a 22-year-old and a 20-year-old, so I was a little late to the mom game. But I think it's sort of a nod to the autonomy that we had as children.
Yeah,
that,
no kidding.
You know, we were the go out and play and be home before dark.
Yeah,
And my parents didn't know where we were. We were on our bikes running all around the place. And so,
it's specifically suburban childhood.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much suburban. Suburban of major, you know, major cities. My dad was a commuter and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and I'm one of four girls, and we're basically staircased. My sister Valerie is 18 months older than me. My sister Tina is 2 years younger than me, and my sister Sheila is 4 years younger than me. So I was born on a team, okay? And we joke, my line with the Curran girls is that you mess with one of us, you mess with all of us. So it was good. When we moved around so much, I had three playmates wherever we went.
Yeah.
And we were close enough to enjoy the same things, but also separate enough that we had our own things.
But was it tough? I don't get a sense from these stories, and I'm going to read one or two of them, that adjusting to school was not difficult for you. You seem to have been the same ebullient child as you are an adult.
Well, thank you. I think it got harder as we got older. And, you know, I remember thinking about when we moved from Minnesota to Cleveland, that it was beautifully timed that we were going to move before report cards arrived home. So I was like, this works for me. Let's move to Cleveland. But I think as you get older and you get more attached, and also the social scene gets trickier. You know, when you're little, you make friends on a beach in 5 seconds. But the one I cried my eyes about was in 10th grade in Cleveland. My sister and I had been in Cleveland from 6th to 10th grade. Well, for me, 6th to 10th grade. For her, 7th to 11th. We both had boyfriends. We were in the school play. I was on the drill team. We were very dialed in. We knew the kids. You know, we weren't all that in high school, but we had our circle of friends. And then, you know, my parents said, you know, Dad's got a new job and we're moving to Chicago. And I just burst into tears. But, you know, I'm glad we did, because I made really good friends at Lake Forest High School. I made wonderful friends at Woodlands Academy. Chicago is an amazing city. I had wonderful internships in college here in Chicago. And now my daughter is going to school. My daughter, my niece, and my nephew are all at Columbia. So we've, you know, every time we come here, it's like a flash mob of family.
You also made a certain friend. I find this chapter, the recycled a school project. These are her confessions. She recycled a school project and begins, although many kids are guilty of reworking an existing project rather than starting from scratch, I had the distinct advantage of attending so many schools with so many different teachers and curriculums that if I recycle a project, there's no way to trace it. This particular opportunity keeps presenting itself, and so I keep taking it. So, in essence, one of your first boyfriends was Thomas Edison.
Yeah, Thomas Alva Edison. And the thing that was you know, I had a little bit of a lazy streak, like any kid. If you don't have to do it 100%, you know, you find the shortcut. And so originally, when I was in, I guess it was Michigan, I think the story is that we had to come up with a great American. And I don't know. So, you know, they show this list. I'm third grade. Who was a great American? And it listed that Thomas Alva Edison had invented the light bulb. I'm like, well, that's impressive. Okay, I want to know more about this guy.
You became something of an expert.
Yeah, I did.
We got to take a break. We'll be back. And she's going to be here for the whole hour. Cynia Curran Finfer, the author of Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood, Truish Tales of an Analog Upbringing. We will explain, or ask Cynia to explain what truish means. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. It's me, Rick Kogan, talking to Cynia Curran Finfer about her Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood, Truish Tales of an Analog Upbringing. Sitting with us is the one and only Jennifer Bosnos, who we will bring into this conversation a little bit later. There are very few writers I know who will quote the great, great, sort of great pitcher Vernon Law,
yes,
which Cynia does in this book. She quotes him saying, "Experience is a tough teacher. You get the test first and the lesson later." About this book, the Kirkus Review has written, they find it, these 13 vignettes that eloquently capture the essence of childhood. They go on to say that the author, that would be you, Cynia, is consistently funny throughout this book, reminding readers that childhood bruises don't always have to be serious. The tales convey some fine lessons, noting that, quote, by getting it wrong, we find our way to the right. Back to composing this book, you said you had initially some like 30 stories, but did you conceptualize this as a book? Did you say to yourself, I'm going to sit down and write some short essays?
Well, I think this thing, going back to the Jenny Nash idea, I thought, wow, I could do that. I couldn't do, you know, a novel and all of the structure that involves with that. But so I started, you know, you're kind of driving around and you're like, oh yeah, that story, and you write it down. And I had a list of probably 20 or 25. And then my idea was to just get it on paper. My background is broadcast journalism and, you know,
Chicago, you used to work for The Loop.
Well, right. I was an intern for Patty Hayes and Jay Blackburn.
Wow.
And it was more research than writing. But I went to American University and I worked on Capitol Hill as an intern for the Burns Bureau, which was a Midwestern news bureau. But I know that, you know, don't keep it in your head. Get it on the paper. Keep working it. And then I also put some deadlines. And the thing that forced me, my husband and I recently sold our house in Los Angeles, so we moved to Rancho Mirage. And it gets hot there and we moved September 18th.
So you have to stay inside?
We shelter in place from about noon until 6. And so I figured, okay, this is a gift. Let's just nail my butt to a chair and get this done. And so I pounded out, like 20 stories. And then, you know, you sort of had to say, well, what are the stronger ones? What are the greater arcs? And also some things sort of overlap to each other. So I wanted each story to sort of have its own thing.
Did you trust your memory?
Oh, well, that's why it's True Wish.
True Wish, okay. I get it.
You know,
that guy's name wasn't Billy, it was Tommy.
Well, and also I wanted to respect both my sister's privacy and my childhood friend's privacy. So
highly respect your parents' privacy in this book.
Yes.
I do not think their names are mentioned. Certainly their professions are not mentioned. For a time, I thought that your dad was kind of like some kind of escaped convict.
I know. Well, the moving around a lot. Let's explain that right now. My father was a career finance guy,
yes.
And we grew up in the 60s when if you got a job, the first company took over your mortgage and paid for your moving.
Yeah,
so my dad's like, okay,
sure.
And so, we're little, we go along. And so that was just when you're a child, you only know your life.
Of course.
But in bouncing around to these different suburban neighborhoods, I ran into kids whose parents worked for IBM, which jokingly referred to as I've been moved.
Mm-hmm.
Because anytime you had a promotion, you move from Atlanta to Cincinnati to whatever. And so there was sort of a class of kid that was bouncing around. And as I said, it was okay when we were little. As we got older, it got trickier.
Sure.
But the truish thing is, these are half a century ago, gulp. And there are certain things that burn in your head as far, you know, you burn your fingers on the stove, you know the stove is hot. But I think also these are stories that are epic in my heart and in my head, that I learned a lesson or I did something really wrong. And that's how you learn.
Do you mind if I read an entire story? It's only a couple pages.
I would love to hear you read a story of mine.
My favorite place in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, is a family farm a short walk from our house. It is my oasis. I am cordial with Joe, the boy my age, but solid friends with his younger sister, Lucy. This gives me passage to sledding down their significant hill, chasing chickens and collecting eggs, playing fetch with their dogs, enjoying their well-stocked oversized sandbox, petting and feeding the two horses, playing in the hayloft, eating wild blackberries in their field, and playing with litters of kittens each spring. This arrangement is heaven on earth to me and agreeable to my parents. I have access to animals and activities straight out of a Norman Rockwell painting, and it all stays down the street. I love it all, but find singular joy in having a mob of kittens crawl all over me, clawing my skull, biting my fingers, and using me as their personal play structure. The harsh reality is that after 2 months' time, these kittens all need to find a home. Animal lovers to the bone, the family simply can't continue to absorb an ever-increasing population of cats. Word is put out that a new bunch of free kittens is available, and one by one, my playmates depart for new homes. Glad for them, sad for me. One year, I become particularly attached to a little gray kitten. Not particularly great-looking, but an incredible spirit. He's feisty and curious, but also affectionate. When talk of putting out the free kitten alert begins, my heart sinks. I cannot bear the thought of never seeing this cat again. So, as is my typical M.O., I decide that this kitten is coming home with me. I lie to my dear friend's mother's face that a conversation with my parents has been had. I have permission to bring the kitten home, and this is the one I want. When the sun starts to set, I scoop my little favorite into my arms and head home. Drunk with the thrill of having my own pet, I think about how great it will be to come home to my own cat, how he'll sleep on my bed, and the sight of my mom talking to a neighbor in our front yard slaps me back into reality. I do not have permission to take this kitten. My mom is far from an animal lover and, with four school-age kids, isn't looking for a new responsibility. I place the kitten in the half-pipe of a neighbor's storm drain for safekeeping and toss my Super Ball in for its amusement while I summon my courage to face my mom. As I approach her, true tears well in my eyes, as I really want this cat to be ours, I start with a crazy opener. "Mom, you see that kitten?" I ask in a whisper, pointing to the tiny, mewing speck rolling happily in the gravel in the pipe. Her eyes meet mine as I clearly state, "It followed me home." Only 9 weeks old, no kitten would have the energy or focus to make that trip, but I insist it's the God-honest truth, and can it please live with us? My mom needs this like a hole in the head, but her inherent decency isn't going to allow a baby animal to be left unattended by the side of the road. She tells me to bring the kitten inside. My heart soars. Then my mother sits me down, looks me in the eye, and asks why I was allowed to bring the cat home. My heart sinks. It's time to come clean. She's far from pleased to learn that I told my friend's mother that I had her and Dad's permission to bring a cat home, as nothing could be further from the truth. Blinking hard while taking that nugget in, she sternly explains that owning a pet is a big responsibility, and this is not going to be her responsibility. Feeding, litter box, grooming, it's all on me. Like any little kid being dangled something I desperately want, I accept all terms with fervent nods of my head, not having the foggiest sense of what I have just agreed to. Then Mom calls my friend's parents to explain the true nature of the events and to learn what else I'll be expected to do for this creature. As the sun rose the next day, we weren't just a family. We were a family with a cat. That's a lovely, lovely story. The cat's name turns out to be Patsy, right?
And he's on the cover.
Patsy shows up in the next installment of
getting out of the math test.
Story of Patsy. You crashed your sister's bike.
Yes.
You destroyed your friend's doll.
I did.
You changed the bus route, challenged a bus route bully.
Yes.
Sometime in the next half hour, I will read that story. You decided, how much rewriting did you do?
Well, the process was, as I said, once I got the, let's do a timeline. September 18th, we moved. I worked till about Christmas to get the first go round. And then once I started getting rid of the stories, and I refined, with May 1st of 2018 being first draft to my sisters, because I felt that they should have a chance to either say, "I hate this idea," or
"Leave me alone,"
you know, like, "Get me out of this," or, you know, "Fine," or "Could you just change this and I'm good?" And they were very embracing of it. The draft that they had was riddled with typos and things. I was this is just rough stuff. What do you think? And they were very embracing of it. And
Encouraging.
And encouraging, yeah. I were like, okay, let's do this. If not now, when? And then going forward from that, I worked with a woman, Carla Green, who I had worked with at the Pacific Design Center. And she has a company, Clarity Design Works, that she helps writers like myself do the layout. She helped me with, I had to get all those photos cleared from a licensing standpoint. Those are not my photos, other than the photos of me.
The photos of you.
Yeah, but photos for the chapters. Yeah, I had clearance of that.
Yes.
I said it was okay. And so we got that, and then she, in turn, introduced me to an editor, Jean-Noëlle Bessois, who had written for McCall's and Red Book. And I thought, this is terrific, because readers of those magazines will they live this life. They will understand the vocabulary.
See, I have the feeling this book will, and the stories will resonate with, not just specifically with suburban kids of the 60s and 70s, not just specifically with girls of the 60s and 70s, but with everybody.
Well,
we
got to
take a short break, and we'll continue on. We'll find out what happens to Patsy, even though it's not in the book. We'll find out what happens to Patsy. I know you people want to know. We'll be back. Welcome back. You certainly don't have to believe me. So far, the recently published Cynia Kern Finfer book, Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood, has gotten getting good reviews. Who's this? Bubby says, Finfer's writing is reminiscent. This is a pretty nice
statement.
I knew Irma Bombeck. Finfer's writing is reminiscent of late humorist Irma Bombeck's essays about a suburbia that no longer exists. That is one point of fact here that I think is, if not the theme of the book, it is certainly one of the foundational blocks of the book, in that this kind of, you go about here, for instance, she describes something that I must have known what it was at some point, but had long forgotten. She writes here, Marty and Rick look as surprised as I did this, and I was about Pink Belly. Pink Belly, a popular schoolyard punishment where a kid is held to the ground while his or her stomach is repeatedly slapped to the point where the skin is somewhat chapped and tender to the touch. It's unpleasant and takes a day or two to fully recover.
It's true.
Don't kids do that anymore?
Well,
No, because they...
Well, I mean, there's a lot... Let's say there's been a lot of sensitivity training, but I think the thing... I think we had a much more physical childhood. And
oh,
also,
no
I don't
question.
Think we were, and I don't think we were as supervised, and that's both a good thing and a bad thing. But I think the other thing, you know, I say in that chapter that my dad said, like, you know, you want to mess with high school boys, it's a different thing. You know, you're only in sixth grade, and if you can't bring it, you know, you're gonna be surprised. And we, you know, I say in that chapter how we liked Rick, Marty, and Jim were the powerhouse of our local football team. So they were local celebrities, and all we had to say to our friends is like, oh, we live next to the family. Boom, everybody knew where it was. And what we loved to do is they'd come home from football practice and just kind of flop in the den.
We'd mess with them.
We'd take their hair and put them in little bunches while they were kind of half sleeping. And they were kind of putting up with it. It was kind of funny, not kind of funny. We'd grind Cheetos in their teeth if they were sleeping. We tied their shoes together. And like they'd put up with it for a minute and then like lunge at us. And we'd go, run out of the room and come back for it. And I just pushed it too far one night.
You also were a feisty little thing, Cynia Kern. You write here in one of these short, and they're all, the book is very easily digestible. It's 50-some pages and 13 wonderfully entertaining and, to my mind, in many ways, evocative chapters. You write here, every school bus route, even though I never had a school bus route, every school bus route has its own social landscape with its rulers and subjects, tight friends and loners, but in reality, mostly kids who just want to get from point to point. But there are those bigger, older, stronger, or weirdly aggressive characters bored in transport who feel the need to bide their time by sharpening their claws on someone else's discomfort. As a perpetual kid, a fifth grader now at my fourth school, I've had more than my share fair bus route torment. Being little for my age and far from athletic, having an unusual name, wearing glasses, and sporting an exotic dental appliance, I am a rich target for some mean-spirited stuff, so I've learned to dodge, to lay low, to avoid, all in the name of a peaceful existence. As a result, I hate bullies. I get that you can't expect everyone to like everyone, but to go out of your way to make someone feel menaced or miserable is beyond the beyond. In this chapter, One of these bullies is really, really mean to one of your friends.
One of my sister's friends.
One of your sister's friends. And you confront this bully on the bus.
Right.
And you make arrangements.
He
won't fight you on the bus. It's too hard to fight on the bus. You make arrangements to fight him after school. And you go over to his house. And I'm skipping ahead. Right. His name is Herbie. His older brother, Mark, answers the door.
Mark was in high school, and I was in sixth grade, to give the idea of the height difference.
Here's a great... This whole episode could be in a John Hughes movie. "Hi, Cynia, what's up?" "I came to fight Herbie." Mark blanches, blinks, and swallows a smile. "You came to fight Herbie?" I stare straight ahead into the living room, see Herbie lying on his stomach, watching TV. He knows what it's about. Mark is enjoying my stoic delivery. Still holding the doorknob, he yells over his shoulder, "Hey, Herbie, Cindy is here to fight you." Herbie looks at the doorway, sees me, rolls his eyes, gets up and walks to the door. In that instant, I realize he has forgotten about the kerfuffle, and I had not come to his house. This may have all blown over. Moving down a little, they go outside. He lunges forward and, putting his face close to mine, snarls, "Get off my lawn, bitch." He stomps to his front door, flings it open, then slams it behind him, leaving me in the yard alone without a scratch. Not a wonderful thing, but a big improvement over a fist to the chin or being thrown to the ground. Weighing his options, Herbie probably thought things would get worse for him if he hit a girl, but save face by swearing at me and stomping off. I, on the other hand, have shown up, prepared to do what I said I was going to do. Even better, I have his older brother as a witness, who would no doubt be delighted in retelling the story. I think we both consider it a win. That's a charming, charming, charming story. What do your kids, Mrs. Finfer, what do your children think of this book?
Well, I think they're very excited about it. And again, I think all children think their parents were born adults. And it's not true.
And we're never kids, yeah.
It's not true. And I think also they've always watched the dynamics with my sisters. And when people meet the Curran girls, one, it's like the Patty Duke show. We all have the same sort of vocal pattern and vocabulary. But we're also the four points of the compass. I mean, we were just talking about this. We were over at Valerie's condo earlier. And I remember when some people came to my 50th birthday party, and they'd met my sisters en masse for the first time, and they kind of, you know, I don't know how to say, my eyes got as big as headlights and said, "Wow, this is a show." But I think they get a kick out of it. I think they see things in me as a kid that, you know, perpetuate as an adult, and I also think they see themselves in me. You know, where did that come from? Oh, now we know.
In raising them, you and your husband David, who's noted film editor, Academy Award nominated film editor, and a terrific guy. In raising the kids, did you bring, you know, these lessons that you learn and have written about in Confessions of a Helmet Free Childhood, these are obviously in your mind all the time. And as your kids encounter different things, how does that?
Well, one thing I definitely said was be nice to the new kids. Whenever school was starting, I said, be extra nice. They're really wobbly. They're like, they have no internal compass. It's all been changed. And then the other thing I once told them when they started pouting because they didn't get invited to something, we all hate that. I said, look, grab this right now. Nobody gets invited to everything. And the sooner you accept that, the happier you're going to be. It happens to grown-ups too. And I mean, the whole Facebook social media thing has just thrown, you know, alcohol and open wounds. And I've just said, you know, we had a situation where I took some of Scott's friends to Magic Mountain, which is the local amusement park. And as we pulled up, I said, look, I have one rule. No social media today. And they're like, oh, what? Because, you know, that was going to be so fun, taking pictures. And I said,
it's an amusement park.
I said, look, I couldn't take everybody. And someone's going to be very hurt that they weren't part of it.
Yeah.
So turn off the phones, have a great time, And, you know, next time I'll bring three others. But I think that's really important. So I think the things that stuck with me, the things that stung me as a kid, I wanted to make clear to my kids that, like, you know, that's not okay. And I think it's also really important for adults to understand that, you know, sometimes they brush off, oh, they're just kids, he'll get over it. The first cut is the deepest, whether it's you get punched in the face or you don't get picked for a team or you try out for the play and it doesn't work. It really, really hurts. And not that you mollycoddle them, but I think you have to validate that pain. And in validating it, it helps them get over it.
Yeah. You like your kids?
I adore my kids. I've said if nothing else happens to me for the rest of my life, I won the lottery twice.
And you still, you let your daughter go to Columbia College.
I know.
We will talk after a commercial break, a short commercial break, with Jennifer Bosnos, a not childhood friend, but a, you know, teenage friend of Cynthia's. I want desperately her, one of the smartest people I know, I want her impression of this and whether it reads like Cynthia, whether it is Cynthia. Is it the Cynthia you met shortly after these adventures and misadventures in this thing? It really does. One of the things for me, it really grabs how I think. I mean, I had some troubles as a young man and with goofy parents and especially goofy mom. But there was a freedom in confronting. There was a real strength in confronting your problems and even indeed lying to get out of some of your jams. I think it made for stronger kids. Nothing against all of you, you know, millennials listening to the show now, but there's something wonderfully evocative about all this. Let's take a little break and see what Jen Bosnos has to say about all this. Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Cynthia Curran Finfer talking about her Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood, Truish Tales of an Analog Upbringing. For many of you, for generations, it will remind you of what it was like being a kid, and your mom go outside, and your mom, probably your mom, not your dad, would say be home before it gets dark, and you'd go have adventures and misadventures, and it was a free and kind of liberating time. Jennifer Bosnos met Cynthia Curran 10th grade? What grade, Jen?
11th grade.
11th grade. Yeah.
And when you read this book, you were charmed by this book, were you not?
I loved it.
Is it the Cynthia, thinking back to the Cynthia you met in 11th grade, can you see the sort of formation of the Cynthia you met and came to adore?
I have to say, I was not at all surprised when I read the book. It was so true to Cynthia's voice. You know, this was, in high school, we traveled to England together because we wanted to go to the Marquee Club and meet up with the Rolling Stones. And then, as a result of our trip, Cynthia makes this incredibly clever movie with the lead character being Elizabeth de Tourbus. So, no, I was not at all surprised.
What was Jen like in high school, Cynthia?
Oh, so much fun. And in fact, I think initially I was intimidated by her because she was very glamorous for to my way of thinking. She always had more hair ribbons than I've ever seen and just pulled herself together. I was not, as I said in my book, I wasn't a girly girl, but I wasn't a tomboy. And, yeah, you know, clothes were something I figured out, I think, in college.
Well, you make a good point here. You have the charming little picture on the cover of the book that you maintain are hand-me-down clothes,
yeah,
because no one in the world would ever dress
put that together.
Like, no one that's would such dress a person like uh-huh this. And who's that in your arms?
That is Patsy Cat. And I think I call this early multitasking because here I am riding a tricycle while holding my beloved Patsy Cat. And I will tell you that was a flat surface. We had no fear of, like, running into the hill. But no, it's very much, I think it's very much who I am. The pixie is outgrown. I'm wearing a turtleneck on a spring day. Okay. The shoes are clearly self-tied. That trike has seen some real work. That is not a brand new tricycle. But the cat is perfectly happy, and so am I. And my mother took this picture, and this picture was on my mother's dresser for years. And to a large degree, I've always thought this was the essence of me as a kid.
You do a marvelous job of in your dedication to your parents, Jack and Valerie, to your sisters, Valerie, Tina, and Sheila, to David, I love David. I haven't seen David in years. I really, David.
We'll make that happen.
David and I hit it off because I said, oh my God, you're in the movie business, when I thought the movie business was all glamour all the time. Jen, you've done well for yourself too since Woodlands Academy, haven't you?
Yes, indeed.
Jennifer is a leading dog trainer in, if not the world, certainly in America.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, certainly,
go on.
Certainly the America I know, with her Call of the Wild dog training, named one night in a, it could have been, what could it have been? There was a meeting once, a business meeting at the Billy Goat Tavern many, many years ago with.
We're all business meetings.
Yes, where all great businesses are founded.
And foreign policy.
And with another notable person. And the business might have been named what, Jen? The Mike Royko School for Dogs. He offered that to Jen because you get a lot of, I think you'll get a lot of customers just on that. Because I have, you know, I don't know if you've been reading my column, I have the world, the ugliest dog contest. He used to run a contest in his column for the world's ugliest dogs.
Talk about true-ish tales.
Yeah.
It's nice of, for you two to see each other, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
You don't do it enough. What's your favorite story in this book, Jennifer?
It's the first one. It's the first one. I just love the image of Cynia being the horse with diplomatic immunity going back and forth between the two opposing teams.
Talk about that. The other one, you know, there is not a kid or person of a certain age that has not played, and I know nobody plays this anymore, pin the tail on the donkey.
There's pointy things.
Do kids still play that?
Well, I mean, you know, like I said.
Oh, no, don't touch that tack. That's a tack.
I know, it's a tack. You could get hurt. I think that we did. I've put the ixnay on pinatas after 10 because when my son's 10th birthday had a pinata, it was sort of Lord of the Flies. It got wild, and they really took out this pinata, and I'm like, guys, it's just stale candy, you know, like, relax. So I think, you know, there are, and that you're swinging a baseball bat too, so there's that. But I think with Pin the Tail on the Donkey, musical chairs got pushed out of the way because there might be disappointment, you might not win. But what was really interesting, our kids, Magnet High School, and it was a middle school, high school, they used to have like full contact musical chairs at lunch, which was hilarious. But you had to bring it if you were going to play. But imagine, like, you've got, you know, 5'11" juniors in high school, boys and girls against opposing chairs, music play, music stop.
You like better, throwing each other.
Oh man,
on the floor.
It was crazy. It was crazy. But you know, if you're going to play that level, you've got to be prepared to hit the floor.
Cynthia, the one thing I haven't asked, what did your parents think of this book?
Oh, I think that
they're listening now. So
yes,
be
I know
careful.
They're listening. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I think they were very tickled because, I mean, again, what's the saying? There's three sides to the truth: yours, mine, and, you know, the actual truth. Or there's three sides to a story: yours, mine, and the truth. And I think it was interesting for them. Of course, they remember this through the prism of being a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom's take of me bringing back the cat was very different than mine. And I'm sure when, you know, they heard the Herbie story, they were less than pleased. And, you know, the fondue thing, that was a moment.
Too.
The whole house could have gone down with that fondue fire, but we live to tell the tale.
You must. It is a strange, wonderful, and sometimes empowering thing to publish a book. This is your first book, and
yes,
the reviews so far, the Bosnos Kogan reviews and the others in print have been so favorable. Do you feel empowered? And do you feel
it's been a thrill?
Where are those stories I didn't include in this book?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'll have to go. I want to enjoy this ride too. We just gave birth January 10th, so allow me to savor the moment.
Sure.
But I think there's more where this came from. But again, I think there's a lot of different ways you can go with this. I don't know if it's all going to be confessions, but, you know, just lessons learned or journeys that you have in going through the stuff of growing up.
Well, one, a title could be In Search of the Rolling Stones.
Yes. You think that,
In Search of the, did we find the Rolling Stone? And I've got to believe that David, knowing what it's like to be a writer from my point of view, and you put incredible pressure on your mate. Mm-hmm. By taking that, Jen, by taking that career route, how was he? I imagine.
Well,
he was terribly supportive.
I say in the book that he should get a special Medal of Valor for enduring the singular insanity that is living with someone with the book, because all of a sudden you have an idea and like someone is like, but what I really want to say is like, wait, and you run out of the room and you're writing something. And similarly, you know, I had to do a website and there was all this like, you know, online stuff you have to do when you self-publish. And I would try and get through certain things, but I would hit a wall. And my son, who's living with us right this minute, was called in to help, and he kind of scraped mom off the floor and got things done. And if anything, I think it's good to merchandise your pain with your children so they know that being a grown-up isn't like you hit 25 and it all falls into place. We're all a work in progress.
Cindy Ahern Finfer is a charming book, Confessions of a Helmet-Free Childhood, Truish Tales of an Analog Upbringing. The website, I shouldn't mention that, it's a wonderful website, helmet-freechildhood.com. You can order it there. You can order it at Amazon. You can order it at Barnes & Noble. I'm assuming you will soon be able to get it at the checkout counter or whatever they have at Call of the Wild Dog Training on North Rockwell. it is great to see you.
Lovely
it is a
to see
special
you.
Treat to see you, Jennifer Bosnos. Thanks, Cynthia. Good luck
Thank
with
you,
the book.
Rick.
And look for those of you who read a thing called a newspaper, which is also of this vanished age. You know, in this time, when you were writing about Tribune, had like 1.5 million circulation in those days. look for a story in a couple of weeks in the Tribune about Cynthia and this book. We'll be back in a little while.